So, yeah, I've gone ahead and hit record.
Sweet.
We can just, you know, keep on talking. We've already started. I guess I should officially welcome you to Looking Upstream. So welcome to Looking Upstream, Tate.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So I'm going to start, I guess, for listeners by bringing them in and letting them know there's something kind of different in the conversation I think you and I are about to have than what we maybe have had, what I have had with some other guests. And that's because you and I were connected by a mutual friend. His name is Peter Maximo. For those in the trail running world, they definitely will recognize that name. He had connected us because of our common interest in writing and running. And it was at the end of, I don't know what, it must have been an hour and a half long conversation over coffee. We thought we were just meeting as two friends in the same small town. And I happened to ask something about where you live, I think. And we found out we're actually neighbors, backyard neighbors. Is that how you remember it?
Exactly, yeah. It was just funny, too, thinking about that conversation and just the ease of, you know, we were in that coffee shop for at least an hour and a half and then have met up, what, once or twice since then. And yeah, this podcast, I feel like, is kind of just extending that conversation of running and writing, two things I'm super passionate about. But yeah, no, it was funny how this all connected. And yeah, you even ended up finding one of my housemate's cats in the backyard one time too. It was just kind of a good way to connect, you know, pretty easily.
It's funny how that can happen, and you know, we don't know our neighbors. You know, how we tend to, I think, not really get to know too many of them. And so, which, by the way, this is not why you're on the podcast. You're on the podcast for the same reason anybody else would be. But the amazing thing about this is because we've had those few conversations, and I think that first one is the shortest one we've had. We'll talk for two and a half hours, and just have coffee, and it's a great flow. And I've gotten to know a lot of really interesting things that you are into, and including finding out when I knew where you lived and knew you were neighbors, that you're in a house with five roommates. And that especially is relevant to this podcast because, as those who've listened in the past, this has to do with housing to some extent as a subtle undercurrent. This podcast is supported by the Chaffey Housing Authority in part because there is a housing affordability crisis and all these sorts of things going on in our area and in plenty of others. So of course that perked up my ears as well as to, wow, you have a perspective besides all the cool things you have in your life and that you do. We'll get to that. I want to start with this. This is what's been on my mind and been amusing me to some extent since you said it the last time we saw each other. I don't know that you meant this with humor. You said waffles are important to me. And it struck me as funny at the time, but I don't know. I just love it. And I just want to know, what is this waffle love about?
Yeah, there's definitely some backstory there that needs to be explained. Because it's a very particular kind of waffle as well. It's the Liege waffles you can get at the Push and Pull, which is it's bike shop slash, what'd you call it? Like in, you know, hangout is a bar now as well. You know, it was just a bike shop, but then the owner, Joe Parkin, has turned it into this hub where, you know, you can get good Belgian beers, and he's brought in bands to play there. And then the key is that he used to be a professional cyclist over for a team in Belgium, and he learned how to make authentic Belgian style waffles and started making them out of his bike shop with this super fancy waffle maker. Like, I think it's like a $3,000 waffle maker or something like that that he brought back with him. But yeah, it makes the best waffles I've ever had. And I mean, I'm one for sweets in general, and I think that maybe that's partially just because I'm so active with running or skiing or other things that I just find quick energy out of foods like that give me this good feeling where I'm like, okay, I feel like I can do a few more miles now that I've eaten one of these. And then it's like this cycle where you eat one and then you go run and then you're like, well, I guess I can have another one and then keep going. But anyway, yeah, the waffles, the key if, I mean, if you want me to dive into like the food experience of what it's like eating one of these, it's this thing called pearl sugar that makes them special. And it's these little, they're just, yeah, like little pearls of sugar, basically, like little, they would look like little pebbles, but they get mixed in with the dough, and then when you press it in the waffle iron, it ends up caramelizing the outside edges of the waffle, so you have this super unique kind of like crispiness that a normal waffle wouldn't have.
And this makes them important to you. At some point, you've had these enough, and you're like, I need to put this in my Instagram bio profile thing to let people know this has meaning to me.
Yeah. Well, I guess I've always been a foodie. So having something that I appreciate, I feel like had to sort of be a descriptor of me on Instagram. That's why I put it like at various times in my life. Like I've loved different things. Like I was very into olive oil for a while, and I would even subscribe to this thing called the Olive Oil Times, where it like tells you, all, it's mostly like articles from Italy and Spain or Greece, like places where olive oil is like, they treat it like it's, you know, like fine wine or fine chocolate or something. Like they're tasting, oh, this one is like more fruity or this one's grassy or whatever it is. Yeah, so with these waffles, I feel like once I had a taste of it and like how unique it was, I just fell in love with it, and then, you know, ended up hanging out at this place a lot, the Push and Pull, because it's, to me, it really is a staple in this community for a hangout spot. Like, it's one of the few places where it doesn't just have an hour where it closes on a Saturday. You know, like, if Joe, the owner, is having a good time, he's told me, you know, I'll stay as long as I'm having a good time. That could be, you know, up until 2 a.m. or whatever. And I feel like that makes it unique. You know, as someone who loves music as well, I feel like he has a good taste and brings in unique bands that are different from just, say, like the common bluegrass scene that typically exists here. So, yeah, that part of it is great. And then, yeah, too, as far as like, more things that make the waffles unique, because I could go on about that all day. They are a dough and not a batter, which I think is also super special, because normally waffles are a batter, right? But a dough requires a lot more patience, because you like have to wake up. Well, for him, I think he told me he wakes up like at 6 a.m. on the mornings on Sunday to like go into the shop and then like prepare the dough so it can rise, and then, you know, I think it might even rise twice, and then puts it in the iron and makes them up. So, yeah, and I've definitely had a lot of them. Probably, if you ask him, more than anyone in ever. record is 6 in one sitting. So if you have one of them, you'll appreciate what that means, because one of them, it's basically like eating like a donut. Like it's a lot.
Okay.
Well, yeah, there's a story, actually, if you want me to tell it, on Mount Princeton with waffles. And I can't remember if we've talked about this. We've talked about so many running journeys. This is one of them.
Yeah, well, I do remember you did a 24-hour Nordic skiing event, and you said you had a goal, was it, to eat an average of 1 an hour, eat 24 of them as your fuel for that? Is that right?
Yeah. Well, so it was an ultra ski competition in Leadville, and yeah, if we want to dive into that story, I can totally tell that.
Well, I mean, and I want to bring people in who are not from this area, who are listening to the podcast and could be anywhere in the world, that we're talking about this community that you've referred to, and the main street and the shop, the Push and Pull, is in Buena Vista, Colorado. So we are in the heart of amazing mountain country here, and where the kinds of endeavors that you have here, like this ultra skiing and you're a trail runner and all these things, you know, where you can thrive in that sort of arena and grab waffles on the go.
Yeah. Well, and the Nordic ski scene is unique. It's something that I never grew up doing, because access to skiing was, well, I mean, I grew up in Salt Lake Valley, where it's skiing some of the best in the world, but even there, like finding Nordic ski trails, you know, I'd have to drive like 40 minutes or whatever. But I used to live in Leadville, and it was just this beautiful thing where I discovered it because I could walk out of my house, and it was on 7th Street, and you just walk a few blocks up and you can connect to this thing called the Mineral Belt Trail, which is a 12-mile loop that gets groomed. So it allows you to skate ski or classic ski or fat bike, you know, walk your dog. It's just this great outdoor space. It serves as a bike path in the summertime or when there's not snow, which is like, what, only a few months out of the year for Leadville. But then, yeah, the rest of the time it's this groomed ski trail. And, you know, plenty of people use it. And I remember, yeah, I think it was probably the second or third day that I moved to Leadville, I ended up renting some skate skis from the Cycles of Life shop there, and then ended up, you know, trying it out, and then did the same the next day, and then on the third day, I was so hooked, I was like, can I just buy these rental skis? I love them. And they were willing to sell them to me, and then I've had them ever since, and have discovered the sport of Nordic skiing. And it's great too, an accessible way to ski in Colorado, because, you know, there's places like Vail that I think are, what, like $250 a day at least for like a day pass. But, you know, you can just show up to the Mineral Belt Trail. You don't need to pay anything.
I've been there and last winter and tried to run, actually.
Yeah, people run it as well, or snowshoe.
And I really want to get into to the Nordic skiing thing. I went with my family up in Leadville once last year, and in part because it was close to 40 years ago, I would go to the local golf course where I grew up in Missouri with my dad, who was really into cross-country skiing. But as a little kid, I wasn't. My toes would get cold. I had no interest in trying to keep up. He would blaze the path, the tracks with his skis, and I would try to stay in them to make it easier for me. At some point, he was willing to let me just take my sled and ride alone down the hills of the golf course, and he would circle around and eventually come find me and things like that. And even though I didn't like it as a kid, since we live out here and we have these opportunities, I've really wanted to go, and I've actually wanted to see if you would be willing to tolerate my ineptitude and needing to practice and get out there somewhere.
Yeah.
I put you on the spot. You have to publicly say yes now, I guess.
Yes. But anyway, yeah, it's funny you bring that up because, I'm actually going to go three of my housemates, actually, three of the five. They want to go try it today, actually.
Oh, so awesome.
They're going to go rent some skis and I'm going to take them up there. But I thought it was also interesting too, that you brought up your dad being interested in Nordic skiing, because that is the same for me, actually. My dad was huge Nordic skier, or mostly just like a big fan of Nordic skiing, like just thought they're the coolest athletes in the world, 'cause they're like this perfect balance of strength and endurance. I remember even just being on some hikes with him. I was probably super young, maybe 5 or 6 years old, and we'd get to an uphill and he would pretend to like use his arms as if he's like pulling and like skating, and he'd like name some Nordic skier that he was like impersonating or whatever. It's like, I'll be this one and you be this one. And it was almost like a game. A backstory too on my name, Tate, it is spelled T-A-Y-T-E. It's actually a Norwegian spelling, because my dad, he wanted to name me Tor, which is like a very strong Norwegian name, like the god of thunder, basically.
Yeah,
Thor,
yeah.
You know? My mom was like, well, how about he doesn't have to live up to being the god of thunder, but we pick a different Norwegian name. So Tate was the compromise, but yeah. And it was funny though, because I was never actually pushed into Nordic skiing, maybe just lack of access, but discovering it now has been really interesting, because it's like, oh man, this is like a big part of me, you know, and I'm finding it now in my mid-20s.
Well, from my perspective, that's finding it nice and early. There are plenty of things that, at least since moving out to Colorado, I've not started until my 40s. So there's I'm happy for you.
So many things to do in Colorado. It's funny. Like, there's just, you know, you could be a rock climber, or you could be an ice climber, you could be a downhill skier, a Nordic
rafting
skier.
And kayaking, yeah, and all the things, yeah.
Yeah, and just to be exposed to it, like, that's been a big thing about living here, because this is such a tourist hub for many of those outdoor activities, and I feel like it's a common point that brings people here. Like, most people you talk with, if they live here, they've got some interest in that.
Yeah.
Unless maybe they're just retiring here because it's a nice, quiet mountain town. But I feel like even those people, they probably have some outdoor or active interest to be here.
If nothing else, it's enjoying the view.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, I like to be around mountains. I like to be around this river, even if I no longer feel up to or never felt interested in pursuing those adventures. It's being adventure adjacent, at least.
Yeah, for sure. And that is something I have been lucky to have had for most of my life. Like I said, growing up in Salt Lake, it really is this, you know, city bumped up right against the mountains. Like, I could run from my house, which was in the suburbs, just a normal looking neighborhood, run about 15 or 20 minutes and get on a trail that could take me just endless places, like to ridgelines 7,000 feet above me. I could encounter moose or deer or anything and just feel super wild, and yet the city is just right there. So I mean, here is similar with the access, but it is a very different feel, and a feel that I like, actually, like, just not having a city down below you, and instead you have this, what, like 2,500 person town. I think that's about what we are, right?
Something. I usually think of it as 3,000.
Yeah.
20,000, I think, in the county, in Chaffee County.
Yeah.
But what we trade in are having the amenities and the access so close to accomplish some things that you might want, like, I mean, even a movie theater, right? We have to drive a good hour, hour and a half to get to the nearest movie theater that's not a drive-in, which I do think is awesome because we have one of those outside of BV, and I grew up with one. So for me, some of this stuff is the combination of the best of my memories as a child with the opportunities that I love for my two sons to have and all the outdoor stuff we're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, it's just different opportunities, right? Like, sure, we don't have a movie theater, but the drive-in is something really special.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, if you've been there and just, I remember when I saw it the first time, I was like, wow, this is on a wide open field at the base of Mount Princeton, which is one of the most beautiful mountains I've ever seen in Colorado. And probably the one that I've actually been to the top of the most. Just have this love of that mountain is probably part of the reason I've stuck around here too.
The first time that I went with my family to the drive-in here in BV, it was something short of a storm, I would say, but we had just inches and inches of snow piling up before and during and after the movie. So we're trying to watch through the snowflakes just pouring down, turning on the engine every now and then to defrost the windows. And it was, even though I grew up with a drive-in movie theater, this was unlike any experience I had ever had before.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing place. With that in mind, let's circle back here. You're going to go out with three of the roommates to go skiing today, Nordic skiing. Let's talk about the roommate thing and the idea that, again, this ties into a really important topic here for many people, which is affordability. I don't want to put that on you, though. I don't know if you're choosing roommates due to affordability or if it's, again, you've said that you are in your 20s. Is that something you socially appreciate, that community within the house? What is that experience like for you? And to whatever extent you don't mind sharing publicly how or why you came to that?
Yeah, and I think there needs to be some backstory here because the roommates I live with, I met them because I used to live in a co-living space It's an old church over on Gunnison Street.
That in Leadville?
No, it's here.
Okay.
In Buena Vista. And that was actually how I moved here from Leadville. So I was looking for a place to live. I think this would have been in spring of 2020, and there weren't many options available. But there was this for $650 a room month to month. So, you know, I'd never been to Buena Vista before. So I was like,
the house you're in now.
No, this was the church.
Okay.
Describing. Yeah. And, yeah, I don't know the full history on when it was a church, but at some point it was an inn also, because it still has inn written on the side of the building. You've probably seen it before.
I know where you're talking about.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, and it's a nice 2-acre plot, you know, with a view of the Collegiate Peaks right behind it and horse pastures and such. But anyway, yeah, not knowing Buena Vista, a month-to-month rental sounded like the way to go, right? It's like, okay, I'll move here and see if I like it. And yeah, then the only thing though is that you have, I think at the time it was 5 or 6 other people living in the space. And so there were shared bathrooms. Some rooms did have their own bathrooms if you paid a little extra. But I just wanted whatever the cheapest room was. And I think I shared with one other person, so it wasn't even really that bad. And then, 2 common kitchen areas and then nice backyard space, plenty of space to park, things like that. But again, yeah, I didn't know anyone. And when I moved there, it was, I learned it was people from all over, mostly people working locally. One worked at the hospital, another
in Salida,
No, actually, just the little walk-in clinic here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then a few others just worked in various food industries and things like that around town. And then, yeah, I also started a job at the Jumpin' Good Goat Dairy at that time, too.
Okay.
Which, and I don't know if we can dive into that story if you want to, but that's another big reason why I moved here was getting that job, because I thought that would be a really fun skill to learn how to make artisan cheese.
Yeah, cheese. I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's an important part. I mean, waffles, cheese,
olive oil.
It's a foodie journey. Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, to get back to describing how I met my roommates. So in the summer of 2021, I was still living in this church, and there were 5 other housemates living there at the time. And we were told that, you know, the market obviously was like really great then, and the owner of the place wanted to sell it. And we'd been informed that if it gets sold, we'd all basically just get kicked out on a whim, you know?
Okay.
And none of us liked that situation because, you know, it's like, what are you going to do? Just, you know, especially summertime for a lot of these people, like, you know, they have one was working for a rafting company, which, you know, it's kind of the height of your season, right?
You know,
could you imagine getting kicked out and not having anywhere to be when your purpose is just to be there for the summer, you know? And so all of us had actually really liked living together, and it was amazing. It was the best chemistry in the house that I'd felt since moving there in that spring of 2020, because, you know, there's just certain people that click better with others in living situations.
Sure.
We were all between the ages of 20 and 30, which I think is it, you know, we blended well. We had 2 from Louisiana, 1 from Ohio, another from the Midwest, and then myself coming from Leadville, but Utah before that. We told each other, if we can find a way to keep living together, we should make this happen, because we've built something special, you know, and we don't want to lose that, because it is really hard to find this, you know, finding 6 people that all work together like this.
Yeah.
And we, by some luck, I guess, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, we found the house behind your house, which was for rent for, it was a year lease, and it had 6 bedrooms, which is really rare to find a house to rent with 6 bedrooms. And then probably even more rare to have 5 housemates that you feel completely comfortable with, that you would move into this house, which was unfurnished too, and just make it work. And so, yeah, we signed for the year. And that would have been September of 2021 to September 2022.
Let's go back to the idea around why choosing that. Were you of the mind that you needed to continue in a roommate situation, in a co-living situation of some kind? If you could have found a space, a little house, something, an apartment, a condo, and rented it on your own, was that even feasible? Or was that even anything that you would want? Because just, again, socially appreciating the chemistry of that group.
Yeah, and that's a good question. And I feel like it's unique because of the chemistry of the group, right? And just how strongly we felt that we had something that was really working. You know, because it is really a cool experience, especially when you're younger, to be able to come back to the house and feel like there's always something going on, or at least an opportunity. And I think that's the best part about this group, is that it's not like I come home and it's, you know, I feel like I have to go do this or that, or that there's a party happening, but I want to just chill. But it's more just, you know, somebody's doing something interesting in the day. And if you want to be involved with that, or if you want to just have a nice conversation with someone, who you relate with, you know, they're there. It's like it's a family unit kind of. And I think that has become really special. And, you know, and that's not to say that I haven't had thoughts about what it would be like living alone. And I've actually had that more recently, thinking about next moves after the lease ends, which is something I might do, is live alone. But as far as financially, at the time in the summer, and feeling the pressure of we might get kicked out at any minute, and right, the summer being a popular time in Buena Vista, you're not going to find much to rent on a whim. I didn't even really consider it. Like, I looked a bit on the various, what is it, like Facebook groups for Chaffee County housing. I think there's like 2 of them or something, and didn't see anything in price range, and it just kind of gave up within the first day or two of looking. I was like, okay, this, I'm not going to find anything better than what I have, and definitely not going to find anything alone for a decent price.
Well, and the reason I, in my mind, several minutes ago, transitioned and got off target here with thinking you were talking about the house you're in now, when you still were talking about the other one, was because you said you were paying $650 for a room in the co-living place, right? Mm-hmm. And if I remember right, you've told me before, that's what you're paying for a room where you are now.
Mm-hmm. Presumably. Plus utilities, but.
Okay.
Yeah.
Presumably, that's the division between 6 roommates, mm-hmm. six bedrooms. And so, okay, being where I am in life with family and in our own house, we're not sharing with others. I'm kind of out of touch, I guess, with what rent might be if you were to go out on your own.
Yeah. Here in Chaffee County, if I were to go out on my own, I would think for sure you'd be looking over $1,000 at least.
A small place, I assume.
Yeah. And two, when you get up to that much, you know, of a financial cost, I feel like then you start to just question the whole system more, and you go, okay, this is just not smart. Like, I could be saving money, or I could be having a down payment on a house or something like that. This money is basically just kind of going to no place of value for me, you know, and still that's the case now renting, right? But at least it's less, and at least I really enjoy the situation that I'm in with the other housemates. And that's what's been able to justify it for the time being. But yeah, eventually I don't want to be a part of that system. It just doesn't make sense for your future. Then you can only do it for so long.
So in our previous conversations, here's one of the things I've come away with in my estimation of observations of you, is that you're a thoughtful, intellectual, optimistic person. And I describe myself as introverted, and I feel like hopefully some similar qualities, in terms of that thoughtfulness and appreciation of just meaningful conversation, right? Like, this is why I do the podcast. Do you consider yourself, is introvert a sort of way of thinking you have about yourself? And the reason I ask that is because I've never been really very happy in roommate situations, and it's the best I can do to deal with a wife and two sons sometimes, or for them with me, to be fair. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how that factors in, and if any of my description there feels true to you, and if not, then set me straight.
Yeah, I would definitely describe myself as an introvert. But yeah, it is interesting then that you bring that up, because I've never thought too much about it. But yeah, I do live with five other housemates, and there is always commotion going on. But I feel like that I do spend a lot of time by myself, playing instruments, writing, which is what I do mostly, is write for work. And then, you know, spend time reading. But then it's sort of this feeling of, you know, if you go to work at a coffee shop as a writer, I feel like I like having the noise of a coffee shop, or like the motion of
the
people
energy,
walking around, the energy. And that's what I have in the house too. And that's really nice for me to be able to disconnect, especially when my work keeps me introverted, to just be, okay, I'm going to change things up and go have a conversation with one of my roommates, or go do something with them. And then I can go back to my space, that's the key, I think, is that I have a space where I can just kind of chill and have things that I do alone.
Okay.
And run. I mean, running's usually something I do alone.
Yeah. Yeah. I almost never run with someone, and it's not necessarily because I don't ever want to, but I find it's easier to figure out the schedule and to coordinate. You know, if I have an idea or a plan for what I want to do this week or today with a run, which interestingly, neither of us can do right now due to injuries, and yours being, I think, more significant and more longstanding than mine, but I've not been running for several weeks. And actually, I mean, that's something I've been curious about with you, because I mentioned optimist, and it can be so difficult to have, not just to the extent, say, being a runner, being an artist, being a writer, whatever it is, it becomes part of our identity. It's how we think of ourselves. It's how we talk about ourselves with others, maybe how they identify us. And when that falls away due to injury, in the case of being a professional trail runner, which you have been, I'm curious how you've handled that emotionally, besides physically, for the last couple of years, with that change in your life, and not who you are, but the labels that get used.
Yeah, that is definitely, I mean, running, is the word identity, I think, stood out when you were talking, because that is a way that I've identified for a long time. In college, I was an athlete in the NCAA, and so running, like, you know, you're told you're a student athlete, and so that is your identity. You're there to study, and you're there to, you know, compete for the team. And, you know, and then after college, I was able to make, you know, somewhat of a career out of just trail running, and had opportunities to travel the world and race, which was really, something I'm grateful for. And yeah, I still have the dream too. There's still a big part of me that has that desire to bring running back. And, I actually have started running just a little bit, which is something that, over the years, I've learned with injuries, is that especially when you're in a situation where you become super motivated, either internally or because you have a team, or for me, like being a professional runner, and then I would get injured, I would want to keep running, because you see it as your identity and your job, and you're like, well, I have to make this work, or if the injury's not that bad, can I still do this race that I was planning on doing in a month, or still travel, you know, to Europe and do this competition or whatever it is. And yeah, and that was something that now I have a different approach about. It's more, okay, I see the dangerous cycle of injuries now is what it is, where if you rush coming back from an injury, be it a, I mean, some of the most common running injuries, right, or like a stress fracture, or you pull a muscle or something like that. Or for me, I had a lot of foot and ankle problems, like Achilles related, or bones in the feet, just kind of breaking and various things like that, that you're kind of able to push through a little bit, or somehow I find a way to, you know, hobble, or I don't even realize sometimes what I'm doing until it's too late. And then I end up seeing a doctor or a PT and they go, you know, you've been totally compensating, like using your right leg instead of your left more, you know, and that's led to other imbalances in the body. And it creates this dangerous cycle of injuries that's hard to get out of. And that's where I'm at now, is that I've started to reintroduce running just a little bit, you know, like 20 minutes at a time or less. And just really focus on the pieces that I sometimes neglect, such as flexibility or strength work, or ensuring that things are, you know, muscles are firing properly, that I'm moving efficiently and not just pushing forward, which is what I tended to have that mentality.
Let me ask this, I think, to make this a little more relevant maybe for listeners who are not runners.
Yeah.
Because you are that thoughtful and I think reflective person that I, you know, mentioned before, I'm wondering how you take this thing that is your identity, and it's an emotional and mental blow. And you have been dealing with this longer, and you had, it was much more your identity. You were a pro doing this. And like you said, going through college and things, I've never had that level of competition as a runner. So for me, this has all been completely as a mid-pack, you know, hobbyist. I hate to use that word, but it's the truth in terms of my status as a runner. And I've been out for several weeks after the biggest year of running of my life, and I'm struggling emotionally. I think anybody, though, has this experience when they have the ups and downs of life, and their identity with whatever it is takes a hit. What have you figured out emotionally about how to cope with this, which you've been doing for a couple of years, I think?
Yeah. I think that for me, I had to let the running identity go. And in doing so, it's not giving up, but it's realizing that there are stronger pieces of your identity that exist underneath that. Like, if you get rid of the running, you know, what is it there that brought you to be the runner that you were in the first place? And what is it that still, you know, drives me to run in the mountains? Because that was a big thing when I finally had, I don't know if you'd call it courage or whatever the word would be, but to let go of something that I really felt so strongly was my identity, and to just give it up. But then to realize, hey, no, I still want to do this. I think that's super powerful and like a strength that I didn't have before, because, you know, you could be wrapped into running for various things, right? You could just be doing it because people tell you you're a pro runner and that's what you should do, or because that's what got you through college, you know, whatever it is. But you have to really want it. And I think letting it go helped me realize that, where I could say, I just really want to go back and run up a thing like Mount Princeton. Like, I really enjoy running to the tops of peaks, and that's part of how I ended up in Colorado. Like, you have very clear goals of what it is you want to get out of your running when you come back. And I think that, you know, that's even more powerful than just being a pro runner, writing a schedule like, oh, I'm going to race here and race here just because that's what people want me to do, or my sponsors say I should do. Like, yeah, that's great, but it also isn't really what you want out of the sport, or you could get away with not knowing. And yeah, for me, that's been the key, is figuring out just how much I actually do still love the sport and would like to get back to it and do it in a way that fits my identity better. Yeah, and that's another piece too, is just discovering when you just take the label off of running, like what are those pieces of yourself that made you a good runner, whether that just be, you know, I would think of optimism as a trait that I've have in my life that I am able to stand by, I guess, in many different times or low points. And that's something that I think that I saw more clearly after losing running. Be like, oh, no, I think I am still a person who can be very positive about my direction in life and going toward my goals, even when something supposedly bad happens. I just have this perspective where, like, okay, yeah, I can't run right now, but there's other things that I could do that I could be working on that will make me a better runner when I get back to it, or other things I can do in the meantime that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. Like, I think finding my creative side was something new in the past 2 or 3 years, after suffering from some big injuries. And my writing and music have come back and flourished in a way that I wouldn't have allowed them to otherwise.
I think those stories, like what you just said about it, it created an opening for you to dig deeper into something, or completely newly to creating, happens for some people in this way sometimes. And I'm thinking of the musician and singer, the singer-songwriter Jack Johnson from Hawaii. He, if I remember his story correctly, he was pretty young when he was on his way to becoming a pro surfer. That it was his ambition. He was a surfer growing up in Hawaii. And it was only when he had an injury, I don't want to misstate it. For some reason, I'm thinking it was maybe a broken leg. I don't know if it was a back thing. I'm sure Google could give us the answer if somebody out there is really that curious. The point is, he picked up a guitar. And that's when he was, you know, set out of the ocean. He had no choice. And that's now what we know him most for. And the biggest, brightest ripples he has made on the world is as a musician, a singer and songwriter. That's his purpose, much more than surfing might have been.
Yeah. And that's, I can't speak for Jack's case, but the way I feel in losing one identity and gaining another is just that there is something that flows naturally from one to the other. Like, there's something in me that is the same, you know, that's allowed me to succeed in the one thing and carried over into the other. And that gives me a feeling like I haven't lost something. Like, I'm not just like throwing running away. Like, I did definitely learn things about who I am, and it strengthened parts of me that I carry over into music or into writing or whatever it be.
That is such an amazing point. I'm glad you brought it up, because what we're talking about here is the essence of what we carry to no matter what it is we do, right? So you are still the same person, whether someone calls you runner, calls you writer, or whatever. You know, these deeper questions are things that I just find myself over the years just continuing to ponder and having to circle back to.
Yeah. You know you're having a good conversation if you make it to a place like that, I think.
I think it's never ending, the learning from these things, the processing of it. And I feel like I'm in an especially creative place, especially coming out of the last few years that we've all experienced. And now with having running set aside temporarily for me, some similar things are happening. I'm spending a lot more time with writing and making art and doing the different things. So I want to bring us back to this idea of home. You had mentioned this idea. You've started pondering, when do I and how do I probably shift from renting to maybe owning, or where do I set down those roots? And I think that part of that question for you has to do with a really interesting potential path that you have been on related to earthships. If people are familiar with those, I've seen some of them in Taos, New Mexico. And that also is where you have some background in that. And if you'll bear with me here while I pile onto this, I think that you seem to be pondering the concept of home. And what does that mean? With deeper roots and longevity. Am I hearing that right? In previous conversations.
Definitely correct. I feel like with a term like earthship, we should probably define what that is for people, because I'll say it and people will be like, wait, did you say spaceship or what are you talking about? And it's really just, it refers to a style of architecture that started back in the 70s by a renowned architect, Michael Reynolds, based in New Mexico. And basically what he did was go out in the middle of the desert in Taos, where he could find cheap land and no building regulations and just practice and play. And I think it was his father or someone in his family was very keen on just using recycled materials, or almost never got rid of anything, like for their whole life, like any can, you know, from beans or whatever it was, they would just keep in the house or, you know, outside in their backyard. And so he got this idea of, you know, collecting garbage basically, and how do we use and recycle materials to make them useful again. And I think one of his first major builds that got him recognition on, it might have been like Time Magazine or something big in the 70s, was that he built a house completely out of steel cans, because cans used to be steel and more sturdy than they were now. And then from there, he started using other materials like tires, which are kind of the go-to earthship thing. Like if you think earthship, you are probably thinking a house built out of tires, because an earthship typically has 500 to 1,000 tires in it, which is quite a few. And that's depending on the size. Like there have been way bigger ones constructed. There's one down in Ridgeway, Colorado, built by, it was the actor Dennis Weaver, had hired earthship as a company to build him a home, and it's just ginormous.
Where do all these tires come from? Are they working with manufacturers for things that are tossed out as defective, or like where does this come from? I had no idea.
The idea is actually pretty genius, because tires are a problem for the world, and that people don't know what to do with them after they get used in vehicles, right? And they end up in piles or end up starting themselves on fire. And Michael Reynolds, the architect who started earthship, right? He thinks always in terms of resources and what do we have available. And for him, he thought that, okay, humanity has billions of tires that we don't know what to do with. And he just started reaching out and finding that people would give them for free. Like auto shops or whatever that had them and didn't know what to do with them were actually paying money to get rid of them. And so he just showed up with, you know, trucks and some friends to help grab all the tires, and basically told these places, hey, we'll take them off your hands. And then he found this way to engineer them into walls. And what you do basically is you take a tire and you fill it with dirt, just dirt from the ground, basic dirt. And then that makes the tire about, I don't know, maybe 200, 300 pounds when you fill it completely with dirt. And you even sledgehammer the dirt into the tire so that the tire is completely bulging and sturdy when you're done. And then you move on to the next one and the next one, and you build a wall completely out of tires. And the wall is very soundproof and structural. They've done tests and things on them over the years, because like I said, this started in the 70s, so they've had 50 years now to kind of hone the craft of building with tires. Because he'll admit the first few builds that he did were, you know, probably dangerous or people couldn't live in them, you know, but that was part of the point, is that you experiment and you do things out of the box so that you find better ways to live. Because, you know, most building materials now are not that great, or we just have set ways of doing things that aren't the most efficient means, or aren't using basic energy from the sun, you know, like harnessing solar, or they don't have the most efficient means of recycling water through the house that they could. He just wanted to think about these basic concepts of a home and how do we do them more efficiently, and specifically too, for off-grid living. Because where he was building these things out in the middle of nowhere in the desert of Taos, there pretty much were no wells. So, you know, he was finding the most efficient means to recycle water through the house so that you could use the least amount possible, or collect rainwater, have cisterns in the home. These various concepts, right, evolving over the years. And so if you go back to how I got involved with Earthship, I'd heard about the concept just through being interested in sustainable living, and that Taos is not that far away. It's only about 3 hours driving from here. And so I had researched it online and found out that there was a whole academy that you can go through. Michael Reynolds has built this school basically to teach people about his building style. And it's also become a community in the sense that they, as an organization, will go out and do humanitarian builds in different parts of the world, and teach people how to build, be it a school or different houses in a village, and using tires, but also materials from around the area, that would make sense. Because every area is going to have unique, resources, I guess, that you can use to build. So no Earthship will really look or work the same.
I want to keep on with this thread that we're pulling at here with Earthships. I appreciate the background, the history on it. But I think there's deeper, you've mentioned things that kind of hint at sustainability and how we use our resources. And I'm thinking there's probably a deeper feeling and awareness you have and what that means to you.
Yeah. I would say the biggest thing that struck me about Earthships was just how much sense they made, and how when I returned back to living in a normal suburban house, I started to notice the things that didn't make sense.
Like what?
Like just simple things, think about a gutter that's sending water away from the house. You're like, this is a very precious resource, water, especially in Colorado.
Yeah.
And why is it that we aren't collecting the water? Why aren't we using it? And that's what an Earthship would do, right? And, you know, there's various laws in different places about water rights and things, but just the base, like if you just forget laws, forget everything, like, shouldn't it make sense that the place where you live takes advantage of what nature just gives you, and you find a way to use those things, and water being one of those?
Well, absolutely. And I would assume, though, you mentioned water rights, huge, huge issue. I can't say I'm well versed in it, but I would have to guess that even staying within the laws on this subject, the rain that falls from the sky onto your roof and you contain within your system and can cycle through and make use of it multiple times, I'm not sure anybody else gets to own the water rights over that.
But they do, yeah.
So others can own the water that falls onto my house on property I own.
So I'm not sure exactly on the laws here, but I don't think if you wanted to just build a cistern in your backyard and collect rainwater in your house here, I think that would be illegal.
To build the cistern?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay.
I don't even know if you could find a way to connect it into your, you know, if you say wanted to recycle it into your house, I don't even know.
Into the existing
structure. They would allow you to do that.
Okay. Well, stipulating that, I think I'll speak for both of us, and correct me if I'm wrong, but neither of us are the legal experts on this, mm-hmm. so I'm not going to try to take us further down that road. Mm-hmm. I've possibly already said something that didn't make sense.
No, and this is part of the issue, because at this point, I don't even think about if I wanted to build an Earthship, building it within city limits. Like, I just am already sort of committed to, all right, this is going to have to be outside of city limits where regulations are less, and I don't have to even worry about any of these things. They'll still be things that you have to,
sure,
you know, do according to the law, which makes sense, but there'll be a lot less restrictions if you pick something outside of city limits to build off, you know, that's okay. made for off-grid home living, okay. basically.
Why is it so important to you? And by the way, I mean, I'm asking questions out of curiosity, yeah. just so we go deeper, but I'm in the same place, and I've never understood. We have the sunlight, we have technology for solar power, we have common sense possibilities, and we don't use them nearly as much as we should. And it becomes a political thing and a social thing. And then there's even just a habitual thing. We're all in the habits of building the houses we have. This is what's normal. I go with what's normal, even if it doesn't make sense. So I'm with you in thinking that we should live in common sense ways and make use of the resources we have well. But why, if you'll elaborate, what else are you thinking about in the bigger picture of sustainability and what the future is? And I guess with regard to the fact you've mentioned you're in your 20s, I've mentioned I'm in my 40s. We're talking about a difference of generation here, and my sons are coming along not too far behind you. So I care about their future. What are you thinking about the future?
I think that it will be important that we have an awareness of nature and the way that it impacts our basic ways of life. I think that it's dangerous if we assume that nature is just this force outside of the city walls that does its thing, and here we have our little bubble, you know, of our suburbia where we get our electricity from the plant down the road and we don't know anything about it. You know, we get our water from the town and we don't know anything about how that works. And, you know, we basically, for convenience sake or to be able to do other things, we've just sort of foregone the basics or even caring to inform ourselves about how they work. So I think that that's a good step, because that's the basics of life is what you're talking about. If you're talking about, you know, water and your ability to stay warm, you know, or handle the elements with a structure, or your ability to harness electricity or have, you know, internet, things like that, all things that you could take into your own hands. And I think that's what Earthship does, or at least having a concept about the ways in which it's done so that you can know, okay, I like the way my society does this actually, so I'm just going to let that be done that way. And, you know, or if you don't, you can be like, well, then I am going to take it into my own hands. And I think that just giving yourself that power and freedom is really important. Because yeah, we are in a space where I would be worried about what the future brings. And in terms of conservation or the environment, or just if this lack of awareness continues, then I think that we might get to that point where we're like, oh shoot, like we did kind of destroy all those forests or used all of that one particular resource, and now it's not going to come back for the next generation. Like that's, you know, you don't want to be the one that just says it's like, oh well, it sucks for them. You know, you want to like make sure that the future is solid and that the cycles are sustainable. Because I think at its roots, most of how nature works is in a cycle that's healthy and just, you know, sustains itself and comes back. And I guess I've dove a little bit into Native American literature recently, and is something I'd like to continue to explore more. But that is something really interesting if you take a look at the peoples that were here before us and that were here for thousands of years and just living with these cycles of nature and having no problems, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, we've only been here a few hundred years and it seems like we have a lot of problems with the way we're living and the land that we're living on, and with us not being finding ways to continue our lifestyles, right? Whereas these people that were here before us, they had this lifestyle, it worked with the environment, they could continue it, and they continued it on. And they had a lot of practices that, you know, we've sort of taken from them. Like, I think fire mitigation actually is a Native American learned thing for us, like creating forest pathways that allow for healthy migration of wildlife and things like that.
Okay.
I think they're understanding of how to use medicinal plants or how to grow agriculture in the various regions of this country was well beyond our understanding. Or I think I read a quote from, I can't remember exactly which book it was, but it was basically that everything native here that has been used for agricultural purposes was already used by Native Americans. Like, there was nothing that we found as Westerners when we moved here that they hadn't already found a way to use. So it's just that, in its essence, is kind of like the Earthship mentality of like, wow, you understand the land where you live and you are using those resources to the max and as efficiently as possible and in a way that allows those resources to continue and not just end.
Coming back to the idea of home, I really am curious to know what you're thinking about there at this stage in your life and what you've been pondering about getting out of the system of rent, and how do you make use of your resources personally to lead and build your future? What does home as an idea feel like to you? What is it you're looking to create and build for yourself in your future?
Yeah, and that's something that I don't even know the answer to yet. And part of that is because I found myself passionate about Earthships and off-grid living. There is a certain cost to that, in that, like I mentioned before, you would probably have to live outside of city limits and push yourself away from society a little bit, which I go back and forth on if that's something I want to do, because I don't think I just want to be a hermit in the woods somewhere. And so it's finding that right place that makes sense in terms of how much connection I still have to a community. And, you know, Buena Vista is a small community, but it is a strong group of people that have similar interests that I do. I think, like we were talking about at the very beginning of this conversation, that the people come here with the outdoors in mind and active lifestyles. And as long as I am able to find that sense of community still in connection with that, I think that that is something really important to me and something that brought me here in the first place. And if I still had that, it would definitely feel like home. In terms of like physically what the place looks like, yeah, I have my mind on building an Earthship, right? But maybe that's not until further down the road, because I think that's a huge step to commit and buy land, right, and find a way to build it, because it's not something that can be built quickly, especially with just one person. I think I'm lucky to have connections in nearby areas with people who have worked on Earthships before and would kind of know what they're doing. But at this stage in my life, I am more interested in just finding ways to keep learning about Earthship and supporting its development rather than being ready to take the step and build one on my own.
It seems like a really huge commitment, not even just in the sense of, well, I'm going to buy a house. We buy houses, we move years later, we, you know, change course on that somewhat easily. But when you're talking about something so specific as an Earthship and what that purpose of sustainability and the intention you have with that sort of house, it does feel like, to me, I really intend to commit to this for an indefinite period, if not forever.
Yeah. Well, especially after putting all of that work into it and knowing that that is the place. I think that that's been the key for me to just have a certain, I would call it like respect for the land. You'd be like, yeah, this is going to be the place. Like, I see myself living there for the rest of my life or for a longer period than most people maybe think of, like, oh, you know, I could buy this house, but I could always sell it. Or, you know, it's easier to get loans on things like that too than it would be for an Earthship. So it's kind of less of a commitment.
The flow of that market is different.
Yeah.
The conventional one. Mm-hmm. Because even if you had somebody, which probably is a smaller pool of buyers who, if you wanted to move from your Earthship, a smaller number than conventional, who would want to buy it, but then you wouldn't have another one to move to. So now if you've made your life, if you're building your life around these intentional, sustainable decisions, where do you go then?
Well, I was going to bring up too, it's such a lifestyle, you know, in our ship. Like that's something I've noticed actually in Taos now, that that is basically the place for Earthships. Like now that it has grown out of there, you will see them all over town, not just in where the visitor center is and the academy and all that.
Within the city limits there now?
Well, at least nearby, like on the other. Okay. Yeah.
Because otherwise, where you're talking about with the visitor center, I've been there a few times, and that's a good ways north outside of town.
Yeah. But you'll find, you know, some for sale actually. And I think it is kind of interesting because it's almost not something you can completely sell, or at least not without some stipulations, you know, because you do have to care for it and have a particular lifestyle. Like you can't just be a person who goes in and thinks, wow, this architecture is really cool. I like what you've done with the bottle walls and using the recycled materials there. It's like, yeah, that's great if you like how it looks, but also you have to, you know, maintain the garden that's been built inside of it and understand that your ways of life might be a little bit different, you know, not to say that you're like living in a stone shack or something, but there are certain things that you would be doing differently than in a conventional household. Yeah. And so I would feel too, if I constructed an Earthship, there'd be a part of me that I would want to make sure that I built it myself, or, you know, with the help from others and learn from friends who have built theirs, just because then you understand exactly what it was that you built, and you also have a chance maybe to teach others through the process.
You had mentioned before your time coming up with where you are renting and with the roommates and being my neighbor, and that there is potential on the horizon of this changing and you no longer being my neighbor and no longer being with those roommates. And one of the experiences that we've talked about before is something, it's, I think, significant to you as a person, to you as a writer, to you as a runner, and feels like a life-changing traveling opportunity. Would you care to share more about that for us to dive deeper into what I assume you know what I'm referring to, and take us there with you, because I think it's just so exciting.
Yeah. So if we want to dive a little bit into my writing career, then I think this is a good segue.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I started writing articles for the American Trail Running Association, which is, as you'd expect, an association dedicated toward promoting the sport of trail running in the U.S. But anyway, yes, I started out with just a small column called Tate's Tuesday Trail Tips, where I was brought on by the organization to give training advice, you know, or just basically kind of tell what was going on in the mind of a young trail runner, because the organization felt like they had good perspectives on, you know, older runners, and ultra running and trail running as a community on the whole is a little bit older, just because it is sometimes a little more intimidating to get into some of these trail races, especially like the longer ones, like a Leadville 100 that is 100 miles long and through the mountains at mostly 11,000 feet or more, you know, and takes time for your body to adapt and, you know, years of training to get used to that. But I just sort of dove into trail running in college and had found some success. And the organization thought that my perspectives would be interesting for other younger people interested in trail running, who would want to learn about the ways that I train and things like that. But over the years, yeah, the position has evolved to where now I find myself traveling to races to go cover them for the organization, you know, basically race recaps or interview athletes. I get a lot of flexibility with what I write, which I think has been the best part, and just that the organization itself is run by some amazing people who have done just wonderful things for growing the sport of trail running. So it's been nice to connect with those people and the various people that they know. And I feel like it's just opened my eyes to the world of trail running, which, sure, it's a small sport, but there are many incredible people who are very passionate about it and, you know, want to see it on the world stage, or just want to bring it into places where it hasn't existed before, or to people that haven't had the opportunity to even know about it, because that's something as a high school runner, right? You are going to be introduced to track running and to cross country running, and that's about it. You know, you don't know anything about running trails, or don't even know where you'd start to compete, right? Unless you're in a very specific pocket, like maybe there'd be some exceptions. If you grew up in Leadville, you'd probably know what the Leadville 100 is. But for most people, that's their experience. If they're a young runner, they haven't been exposed to the trails. So, all this to say that I've developed a career more as a journalistic writer, someone that does shorter pieces covering races and such. But I was an English major in college and definitely have an appreciation for literature and longer works. And the novel is a form that has always intrigued me, just because it's something that's scary too, which is, I have definitely learned in life that the more you push yourself toward those scary things, those are the things where you really like discover yourself and learn more about, you know, what it is that is intriguing you to go to that dangerous place in the first place.
Trail running is good for that as part of it, especially as you get longer and longer in distances.
Yes,
maybe.
Definitely. And I think too, it's just being able to sit with an idea for longer. Like I'll write, you know, something on a race, and say the race happened on Saturday, you know, they'd want the article as soon as possible. Like if I could finish it Saturday, great. Like put it in drafts and then they could publish it Sunday or Monday or whenever. And that's, you know, it's nice for readers who want the immediate action, but from the writer's perspective, you know, I just sort of dove in, and maybe I did some background research before the race, or I had a certain theme or angle I wanted to weave in. But for the most part, you know, it's a very short period that I'm thinking about that race. Mm-hmm. And the novel is something where you could be thinking about this same idea for like a year or 2 years or however long you take with the writing process. And I think that'd be a different experience and a deeper experience that I'd be curious to try, because I've never done it before. And and so I have an idea for a book.
Well, let's go there. That's the because it's more than just being a book, I think, because it involves amazing travel and some of the connections that you've made through this work, which is more journalistic and with the association. So take us there. We're heading to Asia.
Yeah. So it really feels more like a mission. Yeah. should I choose to accept it? Right. but anyway, yeah. So to backtrack, I had this amazing opportunity, one of the best experiences of my life, back in 2018, to go travel to a race in India. And I was also a professional runner at the time, so I had been invited because this race wanted to bring a presence of international runners to.
Okay.
And the race directors, it was one of the best organized races I've ever seen, which is saying a lot because I've seen a lot of races in many places in the world. And he just had this vision that he wanted, you know, not just good runners, but people, you know, who could speak on, you know, the various platforms when they returned, to just share what the experience was like of trail running in India, which I had no idea at the time that there was even a strong running community, let alone trail running community there in India. But it was about 2,000 people that showed up to this race.
Okay.
And it was in the middle of nowhere. Like,
was this in the mountains too?
Yeah, it was in. So the race director had this connection with what's called Coffee Day, which is kind of like the equivalent of Starbucks over in India. So a big company. And through that connection, the race director was able to use these private lands, which were coffee plantations, and this jungle area in the mountains that was bumped up against natural wildlife preserve, something like that, where like Bengal tigers are and cool
stuff
like that.
Is this in northern India?
It's actually in the Western Ghats region, so it's kind of southwest.
Okay.
Yeah, because most people, when they think mountains, if they know India, they think the Himalayas in the north. But this is more if you can imagine like a jungly mountain feel, like what I've never been to Hawaii, but I'd picture like that. It's like super steep, but forested green, you know, low hanging clouds, views and views and such too, when you get above the forest. But it's, it was incredible. And like I said, the logistics of bringing 2,000 people to this really remote spot, I was blown away by, because I flew into Bangalore, and then from there took a 3 or 4 hour train ride, and then took like an hour and a half Jeep ride, and then that was just to where I was staying, and then it was about another hour on a bus to get to where the race start was.
Okay.
So you're out there.
That really throws off the routine of what you might be used to at home when you're training. And you know what all foods you need, you know, before and during and after a long run and all that stuff. It's a different world in a way.
Yeah. But also, you know, an amazing chance to just try new things. Like I'd always loved the Americanized Indian food, right? Like going to a restaurant here. That's been one of my favorite cuisines. And then having it over in southern India, actually tasting Indian food for real, I was just blown away by the variety and the food culture. Like when I think food culture, I usually think places like France or Italy, you know, things where like certain dishes are coming to mind when I say those places, right? Like a croissant or like a twisting, you know, your fork and spaghetti noodles and a red sauce. Yeah, this Indian food culture was just, it blew me away by the amount of options and just that the various regions have their specialties as well. Like where I was at was known for having a little bit hotter foods and less kind of cream-based curries than you'd find in the north, which actually kind of makes sense because the north would be colder, right, in the mountains there, where something like a creamy sog curry might sound really good up there. But whereas this was more like
you're getting down to tropical toward the south, right?
Yeah.
I mean, which is why I presumed you were in the north because of the mountains, like you mentioned the Himalayas. But also, when I think of the south, I think of hot, tropical, and beaches.
Yeah, no beaches, but yeah, definitely hot and tropical.
Well, like Kerala is a popular place that a lot of at least Westerners and Americans, if they're going to go to India, and that's an experience they have. In the south, my experience personally is in the north with India. So that's what was coming to mind for me. I don't want to let us get too far away from the book. There's a big idea there. I'm going to keep bringing us back to the book.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. What you are building in this idea.
Yes. So from my trip to India, like long story short, I was able to make a connection to this race director in Nepal. And I ended up traveling after the race in India to Nepal to go basically just promote his race. You know, I offered to help set up some of the course or volunteer, you know, to, what would you call it? Like scout out the route basically beforehand, find some good spots for photographers and videographers to do their thing. Ended up having this life-changing experience where I was out in the Annapurna region in Nepal and just following these videographers and photographers who are local Nepalese people along this route and just trekking around actually with them both before and after the race because they were so nice. They just offered like, hey, we're going to go hike over here if you want to come with us. And, you know, I had no plans. It was a one-way ticket that I bought to Nepal, so I just basically stayed as long as I wanted and ended up staying there for about a month, trekking to various places, or I'd make a connection and someone would, like this happened one time where the guy was like, oh, my brother, he lives in this village over here and if you go visit, like I'm sure he'd be happy to see you and would take care of you. And yeah, I end up going to that village and had this incredible view of Mount Everest that I will never forget. But more importantly, never forget how his family took care of me because I remember when I showed up, I was the only Western person in this, like it was a super tiny village, like probably no more than what, like 15 or 20 people. And they invited me into their house and then even killed one of their chickens for me so we could eat it for dinner, which was a really big deal. and then sent me on my way. I was trekking to this peak where I'd get this really good view, and sent me on my way with this traditional scarf that you wear in Nepal when you're out in the mountains.
The hospitality of so many places and so many peoples around the world is just unbelievable.
It really is. Yeah, that's what struck me about both India and Nepal was hospitality and community. And yeah, and that's part of the reason I find myself drawn back to that region of the world is that value. And I think there's probably something to it in that a lot of our conversation has been on this idea of home. And I find myself really interested to explore that idea when I go back to Nepal, because I think their concept of home is super healthy, especially out in the mountain villages like that.
Are you thinking in terms of what home means to them and community means there? Or yeah. Are you thinking also maybe in terms of you living there, like in an extended period sort of idea?
Well, that thought has crossed my mind too. I don't know at all what that would entail. I mean, I know certain expats who live over there, Americans, and this one British guy I met last time, and a Dutch person as well, who have made it work, or they do part-time where they live over there half the year and they live back in their home country the other part of the year. Okay. And you know, I'd be open to things like that as well. I think I'll just have to really just see where this project takes me. And that's what I want, is just keep this idea of home in the back of my mind when I go there. Because I definitely know that I appreciate the way that they live, and the way that they respect and build community there is different than we do here. And was not in, it was not something like a lens that I took with me when I went there the first time. It was just something that struck me as like, wow, this is a really cool way to live. And so I think going back, having that perspective now, it will be interesting to start writing stuff down and what I notice. And yeah, they may end up being a part of this book, honestly, which we haven't even gotten to the main
we haven't, point but of it. I love it. But, and you know, because this is how our conversations go, yes, is
you know, a taste of what it's really like.
It is. We take our time and we do wind through some things, but also
this is how I write too.
For the sake of having asked the question, and there's going to be someone listening to this besides ourselves, the book. What is this project? What's at the forefront that combines some of these things and running? And what is it you're going to be doing over there?
Yes, so trail running in Nepal is way more organized of a sport than most people would think, or most people don't know anything about trail running in Nepal. And I think what's really interesting is that Nepal could be seen as this destination place, right, where people are going there to do these specific treks, like we're going to hike to Everest Base Camp, or with trail running in particular, there's races where, you know, you're racing along traditional trekking routes, or, you know, they're going to guarantee certain things, like that you see this peak or that peak or whatever it is. And there is that set of, you know, that's what it means to trail run in Nepal. But there's also a really interesting story that isn't being told. And that's part of what I discovered when I was over there, and that I'm really interested to write about, is that the local Nepalese trail running scene is really, really strong. And the athletes are some of the best in the world and haven't really gotten the chance to show that. And part of that is just that Nepal as a country doesn't always allow its citizens to leave as freely as they might otherwise. But there have been a few exceptions. And if you follow these stories, you'll see what I'm talking about. And Mira Rai is one. She's a Nepalese runner who, she was a child soldier and then just so happened to sign up for this local race in Nepal. And she destroyed everyone, the men included, in this race. And it sparked the attention of the community there. And there was a group that crowdfunded for her to go travel to a really big race over in Italy. And she was able to go travel to this race, and she won the race. And Salomon, the brand, shoe brand or outdoor brand, they sponsor a lot of professional trail runners. They noticed her victory there, and they made her a professional athlete. And that was a huge deal. Like, when she came back to Nepal, she was like a Michael Jordan, because they don't have like a lot of, you know, sports that they take national pride in, and trail running still is not quite to that stage, but it made a big statement. Like, she made the newspapers and such, and so much to the point where, you know, I've had race director friends in Nepal tell me that they're putting on a race and they'll get questions from people signing up, like, is Mira gonna be there? Like, just expecting her to be there as just a presence, you know, so that they can meet her. And I think that that's really cool. And also the fact that she's a woman, because in their culture, there are very traditional roles for women a lot of the time, especially in more remote parts where, you know, the idea of a woman is still like, has very specific roles, like you do this and this on the homestead, and that's all you can do, and this is your way of life. And here she is, a professional athlete, and not only that, but one driven to encourage other women to do the same. And she started her own, she calls it I can't remember the exact name, I think it's Mira Rai Initiative, you can link it, but it's basically a school for other women to learn about trail running and teach them the skills that they need to perform on the international level. A lot of which many women, especially who grow up in the smaller villages, they already have the skills to be a good trail runner. And the men too, just because if you can imagine growing up in a place at altitude in the mountains, and you just get used to hiking on single track trails, just doing your daily, you know, living duties. And then someone tells you, oh, there's a sport where you kind of do the same thing and you just race on these trails, you know, or you power hike them when it gets steep. And they're like, well, I kind of already do that every day. You know, they're going to be naturals at the sport. And, you know, there's other examples besides Mira of success stories that Nepalese athletes have had going up against international competition, or really renowned runners coming to Nepal and getting humbled by the local runners. And I think that the story of the book, that's a big part of the mission, is that I feel that there hasn't been anyone to really tell that story for them, or anyone that's in a position that could. And that's what I kept thinking about the last few years, is that all of the people that I know and look up to as writers in the trail running community, or who have written books on trail running, I would be like, well, why don't they write this story? And then it's a lot of it just comes down to connections, or that they haven't been there like I have. And I feel like when I started writing things down, like, the story just put itself together. I have a few different Word docs where I have outlines of people that I want to interview and talk to, or places that I want to make sure I get to, or races that I know about. And it all just came together in such a way that I thought, wow, I'm in a really good position to tell this story.
Yeah.
So maybe I just should. Like, maybe I shouldn't be afraid to give this to someone else, or expect someone else to do it. Maybe this is a sign that I just need to go over there and do this. And, you know, and a lot of this too is logistics of navigating yourself through Nepal, because that's going to be one of the harder parts of the book. And if I would have had to have thought about this project, you know, not knowing anything about Nepal, but I, you know, having this idea of telling this story, I don't think it would be possible, just because there's certain things that you have to go to Nepal to experience what I mean. Like, even just understanding how long it takes to get from here to there, or that if your flight is canceled, you know, because of weather or whatever it is, just certain things that logistically you just have to figure out, or language barriers, and knowing people that could translate for you, or, you know, things like that.
All of those things are barriers to people. Like you said, why isn't this writer doing this already? Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because they haven't been there, and maybe it's because they have. You know, it might be that those mm-hmm. barriers and those logistics, well, it just is true. It's not for everybody to handle that. And so something I really appreciate and even to some extent am envious of is the work you have done. This isn't just falling in your lap. It's you saw an opportunity that started connecting when you went over there as a runner initially, and then you've done the work and you've done the planning and the writing and the thinking, and there's so many connections that you have established. So I look forward to where this project goes. As a runner, as a writer, as a traveler, all these things that we have in common and why we have these conversations, I think it's going to be amazing. And I look forward to seeing how this unfolds for you.
Thanks. Yeah, me as well. And I feel like a big part of this too is that the Nepalese trail running community has been just incredibly receptive already to the ideas. And I think that's part of why I get excited too, is that, you know, I've reached out to my various friends and the only reaction I get is just that, like, wow, yeah, we need to make this happen, you know, and then they give me more people that I need to talk to or interview, and it just keeps growing and snowballing. And that's part of now how I know it's right too, is yeah. that, okay, this has to be told. They want it to be told. So let's do it.
and we've just found the back door into this idea of home over there. You're going to have so many people to talk to, and this is going to be a project that can build over time. It's going to be home for some length of time anyway.
Yeah. Well, I've thought about that, is that it's already grown to the point where one trip to Nepal, which I plan to do this May, May to basically like the beginning of June. Part of that is it cycles around the Everest Marathon is a race that I want to make sure that I'm at. It's one of the most okay. famous races in Nepal. It starts at the base camp of Everest, and that's at the end of May. So that's part of how I've planned this trip. But already I can tell you that, yeah, I'll probably need to go back over at least a second or third time to get all of the stories that I want into this piece. Or, you know, part of what I think will be interesting is that I want to do a lot of writing this summer after coming back from Nepal. And I think that will help steer me in a direction as well. Like, I'll have this trip where I basically go, write a bunch of things down, interview a bunch of athletes, come back and see what it was that I did while I was over there, what content yeah. I have, and then start to piece together a story. And then once I have that story, you know, then I may say, okay, what is the story missing? So, you know, what do I need to go back for potentially?
This strikes me as something that is hitting you in the heart. This is something you feel, something you feel very connected to. It's not just that it's a matter of subject that's of interest. Oh, it's running and I'm a writer. Let's try to see if I can get a book and make my name, you know, through that. But rather, it strikes me as something that you could be going back for years because it actually has meaning for you.
Yeah. Well, I think the word at the beginning that I used is mission. You know, I think that that's part of what I feel toward it more than anything, is that I like to have a very clear focus. I think that that's something as a runner that I've developed, like a, you know, see the finish line or the training for this race or whatever it is. And I think that, you know, just saying that I want to complete a book, but not really feeling the passion of the story, I think wouldn't make sense for me. Like, I feel like that mission has to come first, and then I'm going to write about it as a way to understand it or to share these ideas with the rest of the world. And too, just knowing why it's important. Like, it's been now, what, 4 years or almost 5 years since I've been to Nepal, but I keep thinking about it. I think that that's a big part of this too, is I go, okay, it must really mean something. And when I had this thought of what it means to write a novel, and, you know, if I might want to try that one day, that this was my first thought, was like, I need to go back to Nepal. And that was just something that I don't even know if I knew at the start, like what that meant. But I, you know, the more I thought about it, it was like, oh, okay, it is the trail running scene there. That's the story. And that's what it keeps drawing me back and makes me want to travel there. And it's something I would do, you know, even if this weren't to get published, you know, I would still want to go there and write all this down.
Yeah. I think it's a fantastic measure of what has meaning to us and what projects we pursue in life. Mm-hmm. I've been working for many years to try to come to this place of understanding of letting the feeling be the meaning and take me creatively and professionally. And I mean that word in the sense of not necessarily about the money even, although that often comes with it, but professionally in terms of what do we dedicate ourselves to more fully. You know, it's not just a hobby. It is that mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is a step into unknown territory too, because sure, I've been writing for a while, but it's in a very different way, like traveling to races and writing these short articles versus going after a novel or, you know, a longer form piece. I think that it's just a very different lifestyle, and I'll have to explore new things about myself as a creative person and as a writer in doing so. You know, like I don't know one bit about publishing at the moment, you know, or at least all I know is from word of mouth of other people who have published things. But I myself haven't started the process of what that's going to be like. And that's something I'm interested in learning. You know, how does one get the creative work out there? You know, in terms of what I'm used to is I have an organization that has these certain goals in mind, and I write these articles and then they get out to the world and find their publication. But this is very different.
Yeah, it is. But I have 100% faith in where you're headed and admire it. So thanks for sharing all of that with me, Tate. And yeah. I suspect that we're just going to end this here, grab a cup of coffee, and just keep talking. But I appreciate having you here to share so much with me today.
Yeah, thanks so much.